You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi.
And I'm Katie Frankowitz. An investigation into a police shooting in Seaside earlier this month that resulted in the death of a Washington man concluded that officers were justified in returning fire. Officers shot and killed 24-year-old Hayes Miles McLeod of Eatonville, Washington, in the Cove area in Seaside on July 8th. McLeod was a suspect in two homicides in Washington State. A statewide alert had gone out to local police agencies in an attempt to locate him. According to Oregon State Police, the Seaside Police Department found McLeod in his vehicle on Sunset Boulevard in Seaside. After officers from other departments arrived at the scene, McLeod allegedly fired at them. Officers fired back. McLeod fled the scene in his car but was found soon after, dead in his car. This week, Clatsop County District Attorney Ron Brown identified Gearhart Police Officer Jeremiah Morris and Cannon Beach Police Officer James Jordan as the officers who fired at McLeod. Morris has been employed with the Gearhart Police Department since 2023. Jordan has worked with the Cannon Beach Police Department since 2015. He previously served as a reserve for the department and also worked for the Seaside Police Department. Both men remain on paid administrative leave. Brown says the investigation into the shooting is nearly done. It is being led by the Oregon State Police. Most of the seats on the Seaside City Council will be up for election this November, all except one. City leaders had hoped to appoint someone to the vacant Ward 3 seat this summer, in time to also get that seat on the ballot in November. Whoever was appointed would serve through the end of this year. But no one applied. Now the city's only option is to open up the appointment until it is filled. Whoever is appointed will now serve out the rest of this year and then through the next 2 years. The Ward 3 seat became vacant following a successful recall election of former city councilor Seamus McVay. Any applicant for the seat must have been a full-time resident of Seaside for at least the previous 12 months. They must be a current resident of Ward 3 and a registered voter. They also need to obtain 20 signatures from registered voters in the ward and complete an online application. 6 of the 7 seats on the Seaside City Council will be on the ballot in November, including the position of mayor. As of Wednesday, only incumbent Mayor Steve Wright, who is seeking another term, has met the filing requirements. Incumbents have until August 18th to file. All other candidates have until August 25th. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting.
Astoria Mayor Sean Fitzpatrick has announced he will not run for re-election in November. Fitzpatrick has served as mayor since 2022 and previously served on the Astoria Planning Commission. With Fitzpatrick out of the running, Astoria resident and combat veteran Sean Davis is the sole candidate in the mayoral race. Davis is the co-founder of the nonprofit Rogue Cell, which works to reduce veteran suicide and connect veterans to community. Also up for election are the Ward 1 seat held by Andy Davis and the Ward 3 seat held by Elizabeth Adams. Davis will not run for his seat again. He is moving out of his current ward and into Ward 3 when his term ends. He told KMUN he has not made any decisions about running for mayor or for the Ward 3 seat. Adams is running for re-election. She was elected in 2022 with a campaign focus on representation, housing, and economic development. This story comes to us in part through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. Housing is in demand, but more than 60% of homes in Cannon Beach are empty. Now, the Cannon Beach City Council hopes to create long-term housing solutions with a new 2-year lease to locals pilot program passed this month. The city will develop a plan to provide incentives to property owners who convert vacant or short-term rental units into long-term homes for locally employed residents. Placemate, a housing company that facilitates lease to locals programs, will partner with Cannon Beach for the rollout. The company estimates the program will cost the city just over $140,000 annually. City Councilor Gary Hayes says it will likely take a few months to hammer out the logistics, find a contractor to manage the program, and promote it to second homeowners. Council members are also considering other potential solutions like caps on short-term rentals and revisions to city ordinances to incentivize building more homes on single-family properties. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com.
A bipartisan bill backed by tribes, state fish and wildlife managers, and fishermen would amend federal protections and allow for the lethal removal of harbor seals in Puget Sound and the Washington coast, and expand authority to remove sea lions on the Columbia River. The bill was introduced earlier this month and is co-sponsored by Washington U.S. Representatives Michael Baumgartner and Emily Randall. Proponents of the bill say it is critical to protect salmon runs and that any allowed lethal take would have negligible effects on pinniped populations. This week, the bill had a hearing before a House subcommittee. Richard Merrick, a retired chief science advisor for the federal NOAA fisheries, pushed back in testimony before the subcommittee.
So I look at this and I say, can it, these widespread removals that could occur under this program benefit salmon recovery? Well-established science has shown that habitat loss is the primary factor that limits recovery of most depleted fish stocks. While it's true that predation on adult salmon will reduce subsequent recruits, the size of salmon stocks is most limited by the habitat that's available for adult spawning.
U.S. Representative Marie Glusenkamp-Perez, a Washington Democrat, has also introduced a bill related to sea lion removal. That bill would modify the Federal Marine Mammal Protection Act and give tribes discretion on how to remove California and Steller sea lions. This same week, a different group of people gathered to celebrate sea lions on Oregon's north coast. At the Bowie Beer Company in Astoria last week, contestants in an annual sea lion calling contest battled it out to see who has the best bark. The contest is hosted by the Astoria Downtown District Association. KMUN's Ava Berardi was there and brings us this report.
Believe it or not, that sea lion bark isn't coming from the Columbia River. Actually, it's not even a sea lion at all. Seth Howard is a board member for the Downtown Association and the MC for the Sea Lion Calling Contest.
Yeah, bring people downtown, have fun on a non-weekend night, so more locals hanging out and having fun. So yeah.
The Sea Lion Calling Contest is a part of an annual fundraiser for the Downtown Association. Competitors in both kids and adult categories are judged on tone, projection, behavior, and appearance. The winners get a prize basket. Brody is a competitor in the children's category. I asked him about his strategy to beat the competition.
I just followed my dad's strategy. It's to press your lips up against the mic and then, like, go out with your chest.
So how does one bark like a sea lion? Shay Valentine is the Marine Mammal Program Project Lead for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. He says sea lions have powerful, large lungs that are built to hold air while they swim. That, combined with their powerful chest muscles, enables them to amplify the noise and create very loud vocalizations. Valentine says there's a range of sounds that sea lions make. Steller sea lions, one of Astoria's most common species, vocalize with a low, rumbling growl. Back at the Sea Lion Calling Contest, Benji took home the prize in the kids' division with his winning bark.
And what was your strategy? How do you think you won?
I don't know, really. I just used my inner core.
But in the adult division, there was a four-way tie, leading to a bark-off. And then...
The judges have decided... Darren!
How do you feel?
I'm Ava Berardi for KMUN.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. An unmanned fishing boat sank earlier this month while moored at the city dock in Coos Bay. Jefferson Public Radio's Theo Greenlee reports the boat was uninsured, leaving the city on the hook for as much as $200,000 for an emergency cleanup.
City officials say the wooden boat sank after its bilge pump system failed. The vessel filled with water and became lodged beneath the city's floating dock. Public Works Director Jennifer Wersing told city councilors Tuesday that the city had to act quickly to protect the dock and reduce the threat of pollution.
Somebody had to do something, right? This is an impact to our waters, if nothing else. The boat had fuels and things on it, so we had to take some sort of action here.
The city signed an emergency contract with local salvage company Billiter Marine to raise and remove the boat. The company will then tow it out of the marina for disposal. I'm Theo Greenlee in Coos Bay.
Wildfire smoke is blanketing much of Oregon this week. In a hard-hit pocket of eastern Oregon, residents are feeling it. Monica Carrillo-Casas reports.
Riding his bike from Walmart, 72-year-old Fred Ingersoll made his way home through Island City in Union County as wildfire smoke hung over the town. The smoky air didn't stop him today, but he doesn't think he'll be going out again for a while.
This is when you really pray for rain. Watch that air out a little bit.
Ingersoll says he's lived in Island City since 1998. He can't remember the air being this bad in years. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has issued air quality advisories across much of Oregon until Wednesday afternoon. The advisories urge residents to stay home if possible. The agency told OPB it's possible they'll extend the notices if air quality worsens. I'm Monica Carrillo Casas, reporting.
Data centers use a lot of electricity. When the power goes out, they turn to backup electricity powered by diesel. Tech companies have stocked up on diesel generators to power their data centers through blackouts. That means if a major outage hits the region, data centers could fill the skies with harmful smog. OPB reporter April Ehrlich looked into the air around some Oregon data centers and how a strained electrical grid could make it worse in the future.
About 15 years ago, Josh Walton found an idyllic spot outside Umatilla where he and his family could raise a few cows and chickens and build a home.
We were the first house to build out here. All of our neighbors were farmers, so this used to be a cornfield.
Their lemon-colored ranch home used to overlook crop fields and the Columbia River. Now it's shadowed by a massive data center complex operated by Amazon. The complex takes up almost 2 million square feet. That's like 10 Walmart supercenters. And it's loud.
It sounds like an airport.
Like planes flying overhead?
Yeah, for sure. Except for it's constant and doesn't fade away.
What's also adding to the noise? More than 100 industrial diesel generators. Each generator is about the size of a short school bus. They need to be tested for maintenance about every few weeks.
Oh, you'll know when they turn on.
It's not just noise they're releasing. Like a diesel-powered bus, these generators emit exhaust full of air pollutants, including nitrogen oxides, also known as NOx. It's a chemical that creates smog around freeways. It can damage people's lungs and increase their risk of cancer. Xiaolei Ren is an engineering professor at the University of California, Riverside. He studies air pollutants around data centers.
They're so tiny, they can penetrate into people's lungs and create asthma, heart attack, even premature mortality.
Outside of maintenance, data centers use their diesel generators during electrical outages. Oregon's grid is fairly reliable for now, but some studies predict that the Pacific Northwest could begin experiencing longer and more frequent blackouts. Its power grid is becoming increasingly strained, partly because of data centers. More blackouts mean areas with large clusters of data centers, like those in the lower Umatilla Basin, could face hours or days filled with diesel exhaust.
It's a risk that we have to understand.
Data centers have changed the landscape in northern Umatilla and Morrow counties. There are 14 hyperscale data centers within a 30-mile-wide region. These are huge buildings capable of processing and storing massive amounts of data, like video streaming services or training new AI models. Altogether, those data centers are equipped with more than 1,500 diesel generators. Ali Merzakalili is Air Quality Division's Administrator at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. He worries about the pollutants that can come from data centers, diesel generators in Oregon, including NOx and particulate matter, also known as PM2.5.
The cumulative impact in terms of NOx emission, in terms of PM2.5 emission, is going to be incredibly high.
OPB used pollution permits to calculate how much diesel exhaust those generators in the lower Umatilla Basin could release during a region-wide blackout. We also ran those numbers past regulators and industry analysts for accuracy. We found that Amazon's data centers in this area could release as much exhaust as 38,000 diesel semi-trucks in 1 hour. There are other options for backup power, like batteries, fuel cells, or even small nuclear plants. But Mirzakhalili and Amazon staff say the tech just isn't there, at least not for data centers this size.
Diesel backup seems to be the most reliable and available technology right now.
So last year, Oregon DEQ began offering a fast-track permit to incentivize data centers to only use generators with pollution controls, like filters. They pollute about 90% less than standard industrial generators.
What we are hoping to have crafted is a permit that ensures public health protection, reduces the emissions by a couple of orders of magnitude.
In the last year, the state has had some nibbles on the offer, but no bites yet. Only a small fraction of Amazon's current generators have pollution filters. In written statements, Amazon staff said the company will use only pollution-controlled generators at its future data centers. But they didn't directly answer questions about whether they would replace Amazon's currently high-polluting generators in the lower Umatilla Basin. That doesn't help people who live near existing data centers there, including Josh Walton in Umatilla.
You know, we have to live here, so we have to drink the water, we have to breathe the air.
Walton says he's not against data centers altogether.
We just hope that the people that are in charge doing the best for the community and the people are making the right decisions.
Given the noise, the lights, and the pollution, Walton says he's not sure if he and his family will continue to call this place home in the long run. I'm April Ehrlich reporting.
A major immigration detention center in Tacoma is fighting to block state health inspections. That's despite a recent court order. State government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan has more.
The detention center has been locked in a court battle with the state. Geo Group, the private contractor that runs the jail, has refused for years to let health officials examine conditions inside. Earlier this month, a judge ordered Geo Group to allow the inspections. But the company got a judge to pause that order, pushing the deadline for health inspections until next month. The state has received thousands of complaints over unsanitary living conditions in the jail. Geo Group did not comment for this story, but has said in the past that the state does not have the authority to regulate a federal contractor. The company wants Washington state officials to get clearance from the federal government first. A U.S. appeals judge has until August 7th to determine if Geo Group will get more time to postpone health inspections. In Olympia, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan.
Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next, followed by the Ship Report with Joanne Rideout. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Yet another election integrity crusader, MyPillow CEO and candidate for Minnesota governor, Mike Lindell, is in hot water. The 2020 election skeptic doesn't appear to be a registered voter in Minnesota. Lindell is an outspoken election conspiracy theorist who claimed that manipulation of Dominion voting systems' electronic ballot tabulators resulted in President Donald Trump's loss in 2020. Dominion, now Liberty Vote, settled a $1.3 billion defamation suit against Lindell June 25th for an undisclosed sum. Fox News and others settled suits with Dominion, having aired Lindell's claims. After a marriage in 2024, Lindell moved to and registered to vote in the state of Texas. He moved back in 2025 to be eligible to run for Minnesota governor in 2026, but the Minneapolis Star Tribune confirmed with the Minnesota Secretary of State's office that Lindell didn't have an active voter registration record. According to the Secretary of State's website, to run for governor, one must be 25 years old, a resident for 1 year, and to be eligible to vote in Minnesota. It does not specify that you must be a registered voter. Since the Star Tribune story, Lindell confirmed to The Independent that he was not registered and said, quote, "You can register the same day you vote in Minnesota." We've linked to more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.